The Gulag Archipelago, Volume 2, Section 2, Continued. Cassette 9, Side 2.
And it was their lookout if they let the wall be pulled over their own eyes. They ought to be shown in a film comedy, but they wouldn't allow it. There is nothing funny in our life. Everything funny takes place in the West. The third cause was the Czechs' lack of independence, their inability to live without jailers, without a camp administration, without guards, without a camp perimeter complete with watchtowers, without a planning and production section, a records and classification section, a security operations section, a cultural and educational section, and without higher camp administrations right up to Gulag itself. Without censorship, and without penalty isolators, without strict regiment brigades, without trustees, without stockroom clerks and warehouses, their inability to move around without convoy and dogs. And so the state had to maintain at least one custodian for each working native, and every custodian had a family. Well and good that it was so, but what were all these custodians to live on? And there were some bright engineers who pointed out a fourth reason as well, that, so they claimed, the necessity of setting up a perimeter fence at every step, of strengthening the convoy, of allotting a supplementary convoy, interfered with their, the engineers, technical manoeuvrability, as, for example, during the disembarkation on the River Tuts. And because of this, so they claimed, everything was done late and cost more. But this was already an objective reason. This was a pretext. Summon them to the party bureau, give them a good scolding, and the cause will disappear. Let them break their heads, they'll find a solution. And then, beyond all these reasons, there were the natural and fully condonable miscalculations of the leadership itself. As Comrade Lenin said, only the person who does nothing makes no mistakes. For example, no matter how earth-moving work was planned, rarely did it take place in the summer, but always for some reason in the autumn and winter, in mud and in freezing weather. Or at the Zaroshi Spring, in the Shturmovoy goldfields, the Kolyma, in March 1938, they sent out 500 people to drive prospecting shafts to a depth of 25 to 30 feet in the permafrost. They completed them. Half the Czechs kicked the bucket. It was time to start blasting, but they changed their minds. The metal content was low. They abandoned it. In May, the prospecting shafts thawed. All the work was lost. And 2 years later, again in March, in the Kolyma frosts, they had another brainstorm to drive prospecting shafts in the very same place, urgently. Don't spare lives. Well, that's what superfluous expenditures are. Or, on the Sukhona River, near the settlement of Opoki, the prisoners hauled earth and built a dam, and the spring freshets carried it away immediately. And that was that. Gone. Or, for example, the Talaga logging operation of the Archangel administration was given a plan to produce furniture, but the authorities forgot to assign supplies of lumber with which to make the furniture. But a plan is a plan, and has to be fulfilled. Talaga had to send out special brigades to fish driftwood out of the river, logs which had fallen behind the timber rafting. There was not enough. Then, in hit-and-run raids, they began to break up whole rafts and carry them off. But after all, those rafts belonged to someone else in the plan, and now they wouldn't have enough. And also it was quite impossible for Talaga to write up worksheets to pay those bold young fellows who had grabbed the timber. After all, it was thievery. So, that's what self-support is. Or once, in Ustvimlag in 1943, they wanted to over-fulfill the plan for floating individual logs downstream and brought pressure on the loggers, drove out all those able and unable, and accumulated too much timber in the timber floating port, 260,000 cubic yards. They didn't manage to fish it out before the winter, and it froze into the ice. And down below the harbour was a railroad bridge. If the timber did not break up into individual logs in the spring, and if it went off in a mass, it would wipe out the bridge, just like that, and the chief would be tried. And therefore they had to requisition whole carloads of dynamite, sink it to the bottom of the river, blow up the ice-bound log raft, and then drag the logs ashore as quickly as possible, and burn them. By spring they would not be usable as lumber. The entire camp was occupied with this work, 200 persons. For their work in the icy water they received a ration of fat bacon, but none of this could be covered by work vouchers because it was all superfluous, and the burned-up timber, gone. Now that's what self-support is. All Petszeldorlag was engaged in constructing the railroad to Vorkuta, winding every which way, and only afterward did they begin to straighten out the already built road. Who paid for that? And the railroad from Lalsk on the river Lutsa to Pinyug, they even planned to extend it to Siktikvar. In 1938, what enormous camps were driven out there, and they built 28 miles of that railroad and abandoned it, and so it all went to waste. Well, of course, these small mistakes are inevitable in any work. No leader is immune to them. And all that railroad from Salakhard to Ikarka started in 1949. After all, it all turned out to be superfluous. There was nothing there to be hauled on it. And they abandoned it, too. But then one quails to say whose mistake that was. It was, after all, his own. And sometimes they carried this business of self-support to such a length that the camp chief didn't know where to hide from it, how to tie up the loose ends. There was a camp for invalid zeks at Kachan near Krasnoyarsk, 1,500 invalid zeks, which after the war was told to go over to self-support, to manufacture furniture. And these invalids cut timber with bow saws. It wasn't a logging camp, and no mechanical equipment was provided. They hauled the timber to the camp on cows. Transportation was not provided either, but there was a dairy farm. The cost of manufacturing a divan turned out to be 800 rubles, and its sale price, 600. And thus the camp management itself had a material interest in transferring as many invalids as possible into Group 1, or else in classifying them as ill and not sending them out of the compound, for then they would immediately shift from a debit balance on self-support to the reliable state budget. Due to all these causes, not only does the archipelago not pay its own way, but the nation has to pay dearly for the additional satisfaction of having it. The economic life of the archipelago was also complicated by the fact that, even though this great statewide socialist self-support was needed by the entire state, and by Gulag too, yet the chief of camp couldn't care less, so they might scold a bit, pinch off his bonus money, but they would give it to him anyway. The main income and the main scope, the main convenience and satisfaction for every chief of an individual camp, was to have his own independent economy in kind, to have his own cozy little estate, a patrimony. As in the Red Army, so too among the MVD officers. Not at all as a joke, but very seriously. The circumstantial, respectful, proud and pleasant word, the master, developed and established itself firmly, just as one master stood way up on top above the entire country. So the commander of every individual subdivision necessarily had to be a master, too. But given that cruel comb of groups A, B, C, and D, which the merciless Frenkel had stuck forever into Gulag's mane, the master had to twist and turn cunningly in order to drag through that comb a sufficient number of workers without whom the economy of his patrimonial manor could in no wise be built. Wherever there was supposed to be one tailor on Gulag tables of organization, it was necessary to construct an entire tailor shop. Wherever one shoemaker, a whole shoemaker's shop. And how many other very useful kinds of craftsmen one would wish to have right at hand. Why, for example, should one not have hothouses and hothouse greens for the officer's table? Sometimes even a wise chief would set up a large auxiliary vegetable farm to feed vegetables over rations even to prisoners, too. They would make up for it in work. It was simply quite advantageous for the master himself. But where could he get the people? But there was a way out, to overload all those same prisoner sloggers, and to deceive Gulag a little, and to cheat on the work a little too. For large-scale work inside camp, some construction project or other, all the prisoners could be compelled to work Sundays or evenings after their 10-hour work days. For regular work, they inflated the statistics on brigades leaving the camp. Workers remaining inside camp were listed as going out of it with their brigades to work. And the brigadiers had to bring back from there their percentages, in other words, part of the output stolen from the rest of the brigade members, who even so were not fulfilling the norms. The sloggers worked harder and ate less, but the manor economy grew and strengthened, and the comrade officers had a less monotonous and pleasanter life. And in certain camps the chief had great breadth of economic vision, and he also found an engineer with imagination, and a powerful kozhdvor, a complex of workshops, grew in the compound, even with official documentation after a while, even with unconcealed staffs, and accepting industrial assignments for fulfillment. But it could not push its way into the planned supply of materials and tools, and therefore, having nothing, it had to make everything it required itself. Let us speak about one such kozhdvor at the Kengir camp. We won't mention the tailor, farrier, carpentry, and other auxiliary workshops. They are a mere bagatelle. The Kengir kozhdvor had its own foundry, its own metalworking shop, and even, in the middle of the 20th century, manufactured handmade drilling and grinding lathes. True, they were unable to manufacture their own turning lathe, but in this camp lend-lease was employed. A lathe was stolen in broad daylight from an industrial plant. Here's how it was arranged. They drove up a camp truck and waited till the chief of the plant section left, and then a whole brigade hurled itself on the lathe, dragged it onto the truck, which had no trouble driving right on past the gatehouse guard, because everything had been arranged with the guard. The guard's battalion was also MVD. And then they drove the lathe right into the camp, and once in there none of the Volnyashki had access to it. And that was that. What could you get out of the stupid, irresponsible natives? The chief of the section raged and beat his breast. Where had the lathe gone? But the Zeks knew nothing. What lathe? We didn't see any. And the most important tools arrived in the camp in the same way, but more easily, in the pocket or under overcoat flaps. The camp workshops once undertook to cast covers for sewer manholes for the ore enrichment factory of Kengir. They could do it, they found, but they ran out of pig iron, and where could the camp procure it in the last resort? So then the prisoners were given orders to steal some first-class English cast-iron brackets, relics of the pre-revolutionary concession, from that very same ore enrichment plant. In camp, these were melted down and carried off to the ore enrichment plant as manhole covers, for which the camp was paid. And by this time, the reader has come to understand how such an energetic kozhdvor as this strengthened self-support, and also the entire economy of the nation. And what was there that these camp workshops wouldn't undertake to manufacture? Not even Krupp would have undertaken it all. They undertook to make large earthenware pipes for sewage disposal, a windmill, a chaff cutter, locks, water pumps, to repair meat grinders, to sew transmission belts, to mend sterilizers for the hospital, to sharpen drills for trepanning the skull. After all, necessity is the mother of invention. When you get good and hungry, you'll figure things out. After all, if you should say, "We aren't able to, we can't do it," tomorrow they'll drive you out to general work. Whereas in the camp workshops, things are much more free and easy. No line-up, no marching under convoy, and you can work more slowly and make something for yourself, too. The hospital will pay for an order with 2 days' sick leave, the kitchen with something added, someone else with makhorka, and the management will throw in a little government bread. And it's funny and amusing. The engineers were constantly racking their brains. Out of what? How? A piece of suitable iron found somewhere on the dump often changed the entire planned design. They made a windmill, and they couldn't find a spring to keep it turned to the wind. They had to tie two strings to it and give orders to two Zeks. When the wind changes, run and turn the mill with the two cords. And they made their own bricks, too. With a metal wire, a woman cut a moving strip of clay the length of the future bricks, and they were carried farther on a conveyor which this woman had to keep moving. But with what? After all, her hands were occupied. Oh, immortal inventiveness of cunning Zeks! They dreamed up a pair of shafts which hugged the woman's pelvis on either side, and while using her hands to cut the bricks, she simultaneously moved the conveyor belt with a strong and frequent motion of her pelvis back and forth. Alas, we are unable to show the reader a photograph of this. And the Kangir estate owner finally became convinced, for once and for all, that there was nothing in the world that his Kozdvor could not make. And one day he called in the chief engineer and ordered him to begin the production of glass for windows and carafes immediately. How to make it? They looked in a volume of the encyclopedia lying there. General phrases, no formula. Nonetheless, they ordered soda, found quartz sand somewhere, and brought it in. And for the main thing, they asked their friends to bring them broken glass from the new city under construction. They broke a lot there. They put all this into the stove, they melted it, mixed it, drew it out, and they got sheets of window glass. But at one end it was 1 centimetre thick, and at the other it got as thin as 2 millimetres. To recognise even a good friend through window glass like that was quite impossible. And the time limit was approaching, to show the output to the chief. How does a Zek live? 1 day at a time. If only I can get through today, I will somehow manage tomorrow. And so they stole manufactured window panes from the site, with the glass already cut, brought them to the camp workshops, and showed them to the camp chief. He was satisfied. Good boys, it's just like the real thing. So now start mass production. We can't make any more, Citizen Chief. But why not? You see, window glass must have molybdenum. We had only a tiny bit, and it's all used up. Can't you get it anywhere? Nowhere. That's too bad. But can you make carafes without that molybdenum? We can probably make carafes. Well, get going. But the carafes, too, all turned out lopsided, and for some reason they all broke apart. A jailer took one of these carafes to get milk, and he was left with just the neck in his hand, and the milk spilled. Oh, those bastards! He cursed. Wreckers! Fascists! You should all be shot! When they were clearing space for new buildings on Ogaryov Street in Moscow, and they broke up the old ones, which had stood there for more than a century, not only did they not throw out the floor beams they found there, or even use them for firewood, but they used them for woodwork. They consisted of clean, ringing wood. That's what seasoning meant to our great-grandfathers. We hurry at everything. We never have time for anything. Does anyone think we should wait for beams to season? At Kaluga gates we used to smear the beams with the latest antiseptics, and the beams rotted all the same, and fungi appeared on them, and so quickly, too, that even before the buildings were officially turned over, it was necessary to tear up the floors and replace the rafters as we went. Therefore, 100 years from now, everything that we Zeks built, and in all probability the whole country as well, will not ring like those old beams from Ogaryov Street. On that day when the USSR, with trumpets blaring, loosed into the heavens the first artificial Earth satellite, opposite my window in Ryazan, 2 pairs of free women, dressed in dirty Zek pea jackets and padded breeches, were carrying cement up to the 4th floor in hand barrows. True, true, that's so, they will object. But what can you say? Nonetheless, it orbits. And that you cannot take away from it, the devil take it. It orbits. It would be appropriate to finish this chapter with a long list of the projects completed by the prisoners for at least the period from the beginning of the first Stalinist 5-year plan up to the time of Khrushchev. But I, of course, am not in a position to compile that list, I can only begin it so that those desiring to can make the necessary insertions and continue it. The Belomore Canal, 1932. The Moscow-Volga Canal, 1936. The Volga-Don Canal, 1952. The Kotlas-Vorkuta Railroad and the branch to Salakhard. The Rikhaiska-Molotovsk Railroad. Camps on the Kudma River on Yagri Island in the Rakasikha settlement. The Salakhard-Igarka Railroad, abandoned. The Lalsk-Pinyug Railroad, abandoned. The Karaganda-Mointi-Balkhash Railroad, 1936. The Volga River Right Bank Railroad. The lateral railroad paralleling the Finnish and Iranian borders. The Trans-Siberian Second Tracks, 1933-1935, about 2,500 miles. The Taishet-Lena Railroad, the beginning of BAM. The Komsomolsk-Sovetskaya-Gavan Railroad. The Sakhalin Railroad from Pobedino to join the Japanese network. The railroad to Ulaanbaatar and highways in Mongolia. During the construction of this railroad, the unguarded prisoners were ordered to tell the Mongols that they were Komsomol members and volunteers. When the Mongols heard this, they replied, "Take back your railroad, give us back our sheep." The Minsk-Moscow Highway, 1937-1938. The Nogoyevo-Atkanera Highway. Construction of the Kuibyshev Hydroelectric Station. Construction of the Lower Tulomo Hydroelectric Station, near Murmansk. Construction of the Ust-Kamenogorsk Hydroelectric Station. Construction of the Balkhash Copper Smelting Complex, 1934-1935. Construction of the Solikamsk Paper Combine. Construction of the Berezniki Chemical Complex. Construction of the Magnitogorsk Complex, in part. Construction of the Kuznetsk Complex, in part. Construction of factories and open hearths. Construction of the Lomonosov Moscow State University, 1950-1953, in part. Construction of the city of Komsomolsk on the Amur. Construction of the city of Sovetskaya Gavan. Construction of the city of Magadan. Construction of the city of Norilsk. Construction of the city of Dudinka. Construction of the city of Vorkuta. Construction of the city of Molotovsk, Severodvinsk, 1935 on. Construction of the city of Dubna. Construction of the port of Nakhodka. Construction of the pipeline from Sakhalin to the mainland. Construction of nearly all the centers of nuclear industry. Mining of radioactive elements, uranium and radium, near Chelyabinsk, Sverdlovsk, and Tura. Work on isotope separation and enrichment plants, 1945-1948. Radium mining in Ukhta. Petroleum refining in Ukhta. The manufacture of heavy water. Coal mining in the basins of the Pechora and the Kuznetsk, of the deposits of Karaganda and Suchan, etc. Ore mining in Jezkazgan, southern Siberia, Buryat, Mongolia, Shoria, Kakhazia, and on the Kola Peninsula. Gold mining on the Kolyma, in Chukotka, in Yakutia, on Vaigach Island, in Mykine, Bayon Aul district. Apatite mining on the Kola Peninsula, 1930 on. Fluor spar mining in Amderma, 1936 on. Rare metals mining, the Stalinskoye ore deposit in Akmolinsk province, up to the 50s. Timber cutting for export and for internal needs, all the European, Russian, North, and Siberia. We are not able to enumerate the countless logging camps. They constituted half the archipelago. We will realize this with the very first listing of names, the camps on the River Koyn, on the Uftyuga-Dvinskaya River, on the River Nem, a tributary of the Vichegda, exiled Germans, on the Vichegda near Ryobova, on the northern Dvina near Cherevkovo, on the lesser northern Dvina near Eristovo. But is it possible to draw up such a list? On what maps or in whose memory have all these thousands of temporary logging camps been preserved? camps established for 1 year, for two, for three, until all the woods nearby had been cut, and then removed lock, stock, and barrel? And then why only the logging camps? What about a complete list of all the little islands of the archipelago which ever surfaced? The famous camps lasting for decades, and the migratory camps following the line of a construction route, and powerful central prisons for long-termers, and transit camps made of tents and poles. And would anyone undertake to place on such a map all the preliminary detention cells and prisons in each city? Several in each? And then, too, the agricultural colonies with their haying and their herding outposts. And, in addition, the tiny industrial and construction colonies scattered like seeds through the cities. Moscow and Leningrad would each have to have enclaves marked throughout them on a large-scale map. Do not forget the camp located a quarter mile from the Kremlin, the beginning of the construction of the palace of the Soviets. Yes, and in the 20s, the archipelago was one thing, whereas in the 50s it was quite a different thing, and in quite different places. How would one indicate its march through time? How many maps would be required? And Naroblag, or Ust-Vimlag, or the Solikamsk, or the Potmar camps, would have to be a whole province of cross-hatching. But who among us ever walked those boundaries? But we hope to see such a map yet. Loading of timber onto ships in Karelia, till 1930, after the appeal of the English press not to accept timber loaded by prisoners, the Zeks were hastily taken off this work and removed to the inner depths of Karelia. Supplying the front during wartime with mines, ammunition, packing for them, and with uniforms. The construction of state farms in Siberia and Kazakhstan. And even leaving out the whole of the 20s and the output of prisons, reformatories, and corrective labor prisons, what was it that the hundreds of industrial colonies spent their time on? What did they manufacture in the quarter century from 1929 to 1953? There was no decent city in the whole country that did not have them. And what did the hundreds and hundreds of agricultural colonies grow and harvest? It is indeed much easier to enumerate the occupations the prisoners never did have, the manufacture of sausages and confectionery goods.
Part 4. The Soul and Barbed Wire. Behold, I show you a mystery. We shall not all sleep, but we shall all be changed. 1 Corinthians 15:51.
Chapter 1. The Ascent. And the years go by, not in swift staccato as they joke in camp, winter, summer, winter, summer, but a long drawn-out autumn, an endless winter, an unwilling spring, and only a summer that is short. In the archipelago, summer is short. Even one mere year, whew, how long it lasts. Even in 1 year, how much time is left for you to think. For 330 days you stomp out to line up in a drizzling, slushy rain, and in a piercing blizzard, and in a biting and still sub-zero cold. For 330 days you work away at hateful alien work with your mind unoccupied. For 330 evenings you squinch up, wet, chilled, in the end of work line-up, waiting for the convoy to assemble from the distant watchtowers. And then there is the march out, and the march back, and bending down over 730 bowls of gruel, over 730 portions of grits. Yes, and waking up and going to sleep on your multiple bunk, and neither radio nor books to distract you. There are none, and thank God. And that is only 1 year, and there are 10, there are 25. And then, too, when you are lying in the hospital with dystrophy, that, too, is a good time to think. Think. Draw some conclusions from misfortune. And all that endless time, after all, the prisoners' brains and souls are not inactive? In the mass and from a distance they seem like swarming lice. but they are the crown of creation, right? After all, once upon a time, a weak little spark of God was breathed into them, too. Is it not true? So what has become of it now? For centuries, it was considered that a criminal was given a sentence for precisely this purpose, to think about his crime for the whole period of his sentence, be conscience-stricken, repent, and gradually reform. But the Gulag Archipelago knows no pangs of conscience. Out of 100 natives, 5 are thieves, and their transgressions are no reproach in their own eyes, but a mark of valor. They dream of carrying out such feats in the future even more brazenly and cleverly. They have nothing to repent. Another 5 stole on a big scale, but not from people. In our times, the only place where one can steal on a big scale is from the state, which itself squanders the people's money without pity or sense. So what was there for such types to repent of? Maybe that they had not stolen more and divvied up and thus remained free. And so far as another 85% of the natives were concerned, they had never committed any crimes whatever. What were they supposed to repent of? That they had thought what they thought? Nonetheless, they managed to pound and muddle some of them to such an extent that they did repent of being so depraved. Let us remember the desperation of Nina Perigud, because she was unworthy of Zoya Kosmodemyanskaya. Or that a man had surrendered and become a POW in a hopeless situation. Or that he had taken employment under the Germans instead of dying of starvation. Nonetheless, they managed so to confuse what was permitted and what was forbidden, that there were some such who were tormented greatly. I would have done better to die than to have earned that bread. Or that while working for nothing in the collective farm fields, he had taken a mite to feed his children. Or that he had taken something from a factory for the same reason. No, not only do you not repent, but your clean conscience, like a clear mountain lake, shines in your eyes. And your eyes, purified by suffering, infallibly perceive the least haze in other eyes. For example, they infallibly pick out stool pigeons. And the checker GB is not aware of this capacity of ours to see with the eyes of truth. It is our secret weapon against that institution. And state security slips up here with us. It was in this nearly unanimous consciousness of our innocence that the main distinction arose between us and the hard labor prisoners of Dostoevsky, the hard labor prisoners of P. Yakubovich. There they were conscious of being doomed renegades, whereas we were confidently aware that they could haul in any free person at all, in just the same way they had hauled us in. That barbed wire was only a nominal dividing line between us. In earlier times, there had been among the majority the unconditional consciousness of personal guilt, and among us, the consciousness of disaster on a mammoth scale. Just not to perish from the disaster, it had to be survived. Wasn't this the root cause of the astounding rarity of camp suicides? Yes, rarity, although every ex-prisoner could in all probability recall a case of suicide. But he could recall even more escapes. There were certainly more escapes than suicides. Admirers of socialist realism can praise me. I am pursuing an optimistic line. And there were far more self-inflicted injuries, too, than there were suicides. But this, too, is an act indicating love of life, a straightforward calculation of sacrificing a portion to save the whole. I even imagine that, statistically speaking, there were fewer suicides per 1,000 of the population in camp than in freedom. I have no way of verifying this, of course. But Skripnikova recalls how a man 30 years old hanged himself in 1931 in the women's toilet in Medvezhyegorsk, and hanged himself on the very day he was to be released. So maybe it was out of a feeling of disgust for the freedom of that time. 2 years earlier, his wife had abandoned him, but he had not hanged himself then. Well, the designer Voronov hanged himself in the club of the main camp center of Borepolom. The Communist Party official Aramovich, a second-termer, hanged himself in 1947 in the garret of the machinery repair factory in Kniazhpogost. In Kraslag, during the war years, Lithuanians who had been reduced to a state of total despair mainly because nothing in their former lives had prepared them for our cruelties, marched on infantrymen so as to get themselves shot down. In 1949, in the interrogation cell in Vladimir Volinsk, a young fellow stunned by his interrogation tried to hang himself, but Baronyuk pulled him down in time. At the Kaluga gates, a former Latvian officer who was hospitalized in the camp infirmary began to creep stealthily up some stairs. They led to the incomplete, empty upper stories. The Zechka nurse saw him and went in pursuit. She caught up with him on the open balcony of the sixth floor. She caught him by the bathrobe, but the suicide slipped off the robe and stepped off into nothingness, dressed in his underwear, and flashed past like a white streak of lightning in plain sight of busy Bolshaya Kalushskaya Street on a sunny summer day. When Emmy, a German communist, learned about her husband's death, she left the barracks in sub-zero weather undressed so as to catch cold. The Englishman Kelly, in the Vladimir Special Purpose Prison, very skillfully cut his veins with the door wide open and the jailer right there on the threshold. He did it with a piece of enamel from the wash basin. Kelly hid it in his shoe, and his shoe stood by his bed. Kelly dropped his blanket over the shoe to cover it, got out the piece of enamel, and cut his wrist vein beneath the blanket. I repeat, there are many others who can recount similar cases, but nonetheless, out of tens of millions who have served time, their total number will be small. Even among these examples, it is clear that a much greater proportion of suicides is accounted for by foreigners, Westerners. For them, the transition to the archipelago was a more shattering blow than for us, so they put an end to it. And suicides were frequent among the loyalists, too, but not among the hardheads. And one can understand why. After all, their heads must have got thoroughly mixed up and filled with incessant buzzing. How could they stand it? Zosiel Zaleska, a Polish noblewoman who had devoted her entire life to the cause of communism by serving in the Soviet intelligence service, tried to commit suicide 3 times during her interrogation. She tried to hang herself. They pulled her down. She cut her veins, but they stopped her. She jumped onto the windowsill on the 7th floor. But the drowsy interrogator managed to grab hold of her by her dress. They saved her life 3 times, so they could shoot her. And anyway, what is the correct interpretation of suicide? Hans Bernstein, for example, insists that suicides are not at all cowards, that great willpower is required for suicide. He himself wove a rope out of bandages and throttled himself by lifting his feet off the floor. But green circles appeared before his eyes, and there was a ringing in his ears, and each time he involuntarily put his feet back on the ground. During his last try, the homemade rope broke, and he felt glad that he was still alive. I'm not going to dispute that perhaps even in the most extreme despair you still need willpower to commit suicide. For a long time I would not have taken it upon myself to pass judgment on this at all. All my life long I was absolutely convinced that I would never consider suicide in any circumstances whatever. But not so long ago I dragged my way through gloomy months when it seemed to me that my whole life's cause had perished, especially if I remained alive. And I remember very clearly indeed the revulsion against life that came over me, and the sensation that to die was easier than to live. In my opinion, in a state like that, it requires more strength of will to stay alive than to die. But in all probability, with other people in a different extremity, this turns out differently. And that is why, from time immemorial, the two opinions have existed. It is a very spectacular idea to imagine all the innocently outraged millions beginning to commit suicide en masse, causing double vexation to the government, both by demonstrating their innocence and by depriving the government of free manpower. And maybe the government would have had to soften up and begin to take pity on its subjects. Well, hardly. Stalin wouldn't have been stopped by that. He would have merely picked up another 20 million people from freedom. But it did not happen. People died by the hundreds of thousands and millions, driven, it would seem, to the extremity of extremities. But for some reason, there were no suicides. Condemned to a misshapen existence, to waste away from starvation, to exhaustion from labor. They did not put an end to themselves. And thinking the whole thing over, I found that proof to be the stronger. A suicide is always a bankrupt, always a human being in a blind alley, a human being who has gambled his life and lost, and is without the will to continue the struggle. If these millions of helpless and pitiful vermin still did not put an end to themselves, this meant some kind of invincible feeling was alive inside them, some very powerful idea. This was their feeling of universal innocence. It was the sense of an ordeal of the entire people, like the Tatar yoke. But what if one has nothing to repent of? What then? What then does the prisoner think about all the time? Poverty and prison give wisdom. They do. But where is it to be directed? Here is how it was with many others, not just with me. Our initial first prison sky consisted of black swirling storm clouds and black pillars of volcanic eruptions. This was the heaven of Pompeii, the heaven of the Day of Judgment, because it was not just anyone who had been arrested, but I, the center of this world. Our last prison sky was infinitely high, infinitely clear, even paler than sky blue. We all, except religious believers, began from one point. We tried to tear our hair from our head, but our hair has been clipped close. How could we? How could we not have seen those who informed against us? How could we not have seen our enemies? And how we hated them. How could we avenge ourselves on them? And what recklessness, what blindness, how many errors? How can they be corrected? They must be corrected all the more swiftly. We must write. We must speak out. We must communicate. But there is nothing that we can do, and nothing is going to save us. At the appropriate time, we will sign Form 206. At the appropriate time, the tribunal will read us our sentence in our presence, or we will learn it in absentia from the OSO. Then there begins a period of transit prisons, interspersed with our thoughts about our future camp. We now love to recall our past, how well we used to live, even if we lived badly. But how many unused opportunities there were, how many flowers we left uncrumpled. When will we now make up for it? If I only manage to survive, oh, how differently, how wisely I am going to live. The day of our future release, it shines like a rising sun. And the conclusion is, survive to reach it. Survive at any price. This is simply a turn of phrase, a sort of habit of speech, at any price. But then the words swell up with their full meaning, and an awesome vow takes shape, to survive at any price. And whoever takes that vow, whoever does not blink before its crimson burst, allows his own misfortune to overshadow both the entire common misfortune and the whole world. This is the great fork of camp life. From this point, the roads go to the right and to the left. One of them will rise and the other will descend. If you go to the right, you lose your life, and if you go to the left, you lose your conscience. One's own order to oneself, survive, is the natural splash of a living person. Who does not wish to survive? Who does not have the right to survive, straining all the strength of our body? An order to all ourselves, survive! A powerful charge is introduced into the chest cavity, and the heart is surrounded by an electrical cloud so as not to stop beating. They lead 30 emaciated but wiry zeks 3 miles across the Arctic ice to a bathhouse. The bath is not worth even a warm word. 6 men at a time wash themselves in 5 shifts, and the door opens straight into the sub-zero temperature, and 4 shifts are obliged to stand there before or after bathing, because they cannot be left without convoy. And not only does none of them get pneumonia, they don't even catch cold. And for 10 years one old man had his bath just like that, serving out his time from age 50 to 60. But then he was released. He was at home. Warm and cared for, he burned up in 1 month's time. That order, survive, was not there. But simply, to survive does not yet mean at any price. At any price means
at the price of someone else. Let us admit the truth. At that great fork in the camp road, at that great divider of souls, it was not the majority of the prisoners that turned to the right. Alas, not the majority. But fortunately, neither was it just a few. There are many of them, human beings, who made this choice, but they did not shout about themselves. You had to look closely to see them. Dozens of times this same choice had arisen before them, too, but they always knew, and knew their own stand. Take Arnold Soucy, who was sent to camp at the age of about 50.
This book is continued on Cassette 10, Side 1.